Moment. My brother walks in and helps himself to a full glass of brandy on the tray by the fireplace. I give Olivia an apologetic smile. What do you need, Henry?
My rooms are being renovated, so Grandmother said I'm to stay in one of your guest rooms.
587 rooms, and she puts him in Guthrie House. With us. Subtlety was never the Queen's style.
And I'm bored, he whines. Let's give Olive a tour. That'll be something to do, at least. And we can go see Cook. Ask her to make the biscuits I like so much. I've missed them.
He means cookies, for you Americans out there. It's not a bad idea. If Olivia's going to be here for the summer, I want her to feel comfortable. Introduce her to the staff. Are you too tired for a walkabout? I ask Olivia.
No, not even a little. But I should unpack.
I wave my hand. The maids will take care of that. She taps the side of her head playfully.
That's right. The maids. How could I forget?
She picks up my hand.
Then let's go. Show me your palace.
We start in the kitchen and work our way up. Cook, a large, sweet, boisterous woman who's worked at Guthrie House since my father was a lad, tackles my brother on sight. She admonishes him for being gone too long, and then gives him a whole tray of his favorite biscuits. Then Cook greets Olivia with another engulfing hug. Her name's not really Cook, but Henry and I don't know her by anything else. She has the thickest brogue I've ever heard, and Olivia smiles politely and nods while Cook jabbers on, though I can tell she has no idea what she's saying. Olivia's already met Fergus, but on the way to show her the ballrooms, we pass Mrs. Everston, the upstairs maid, and make introductions. We also run into Winston, the head dark suit, who's in charge, in control and in the know of every nook and cranny of the royal family inside and outside the palace. Henry once heard that he was an assassin in his early years, and based on his calculating, cold attitude, I believe it. We see Jane Stiltonhouse, the palace travel secretary, a woman who reminds me of a human butter knife. She's thin, sharp, and has a shrill voice like the sound made when two pieces of silverware are rubbed together. Olivia's eyes glow, and her mouth is perpetually open in awe, as we go from one gilded historic room to another. Our last stop is the portrait hall, a long corridor with framed oil paintings of past monarchs, their families and ancestors. Olivia gazes timidly down the shadowy hall, so long and dark, the end can't be seen. It just trails off into total blackness.
You grew up here, in the palace? She asks.
I was sent to boarding school at 7, lived most of the year there, but vacations and summers were spent here. She shivers.
Weren't you ever afraid that it was haunted?
The portraits are on the creepy side, but it's not scary once you get used to it. Henry and I used to scooter down this hallway all the time.
How cute, Olivia says quietly. Just like the kid from The Shining.
I laugh. Minus the elevator filled with blood. But yeah, just like that. Her eyes slide over my face, gleaming with naughty intentions. She whispers, so Henry can't hear.
When you laugh like that, those dimples show up. It makes me want to climb up your body and lick them.
I immediately grow thick and hard at the idea.
Feel free to lick anything you want. Any time.
Later that evening, Cook makes us a giant bowl of salted caramel popcorn. I take particular joy in watching Olivia suck on her sticky fingers between bites. I remind myself to kiss Cook tomorrow. The popcorn is for the movie Olivia wanted to watch. Although we have a media room, Olivia preferred my sitting room, in our pajamas, in an oasis of pillows and blankets on the floor. Henry joins us.
I can't believe you guys have never seen Beauty and the Beast. This place is just like the castle. Cook could be Mrs. Potts. Fergus could be Grumpy Cogsworth, Olivia says, twisting her black locks into a messy bun on top of her head.
The thing is, pet, we have Cox, I smirk. Those of us so endowed really weren't interested in Disney cartoons.
You've seen The Lion King, she argues.
Well, yeah, there's lions in it, and murder.
And kings, Henry adds. The title says it all.
We watch the film, or more to the point, Olivia watches the film, smiling gently the whole way through. I mostly just watch her, because I'm happy that she's here. I almost can't believe it. Every time I let myself, a warm, gushy feeling surges in my chest, like my heart is melting, and I feel content. When the music soars and the credits start to roll, Olivia presses her pretty hands to her chest and sighs.
Never gets old. That will always be my favorite Disney movie.
Henry finishes his fifth brandy.
It was all right, but I prefer The Little Mermaid.
Olivia raises a black brow.
I thought Cox didn't like princess cartoons.
Have you seen Ariel? Henry asks.
My cock likes her a whole bunch.
Olivia wrinkles her nose.
Gross. Although I did read a book once that said most guys like Ariel.
I should read that book, Henry declares. Fantastic idea, Henry. Why don't you run along and find the book in the library? I slip my finger under the strap of Olivia's flimsy little pajama top, rubbing the soft, smooth skin. I lower my voice. I'm feeling beastly at the moment. Olivia meets my eyes and smiles. She likes the idea. Unfortunately, Henry heard me, and he makes a disgusted face.
Is that supposed to imply doggy style?
Since he already heard me loud and clear, yes. He throws off the blankets and stumbles for the door.
That position is ruined for me now, and I really liked it. Thanks a lot.
I lock the door behind him, and Olivia and I act out our own interpretation of Beauty and the Beast for the rest of the night.
Chapter 17. Olivia. In the morning, Nicholas has Fergus bring us breakfast in bed. I hide in the bathroom when he actually brings it in. Nicholas says I'm being silly, that I have to get used to the fact that Fergus doesn't give a shit that I'm in his bed, or that we had crazy, fantastic, would-make-the-beast-blush sex last night. But I can't help it. I don't know if I'll ever get used to servants and the intimacy of having them around all the time. Besides, come September, there won't be anyone bringing me breakfast in bed or hanging my clothes. Maybe it's best that I don't get used to it. After breakfast, Nicholas showers, and I perch myself on a cushioned bench in his huge bathroom to watch him shave, with a straight razor, of course. And there is something so deliciously manly, raw and sexy, about watching him shave that perfect jaw, shirtless, with nothing but a fluffy towel around his hips. It makes me want to lick him, over his chest, up his neck, again. Then he gets dressed, in a navy suit and a burgundy tie, and goes to work, at the offices on the other end of the palace. He said his schedule was mad because of his extended stay in New York, but he'd be back to have dinner with me in the Guthrie House dining room. And after, he was taking me to a party. Speaking of which, Nicholas said I would have a schedule of my own today. A stylist and personal dresser would arrive at 10 to take care of everything I'll need. And that's where I am now. In a chair, in the white bedroom, getting facialed and trimmed, polished and buffed, waxed and massaged. I glance in the mirror and realize I look just like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, getting worked over and beautified by a gaggle of Emerald City beauticians. Afterwards, my skin feels smoother and softer than I ever thought possible. My muscles are amazingly relaxed, aches and pains that I didn't even recognize have completely disappeared. When the last of the beauty brigade zips up her enchanted bag and leaves, I look in the mirror again. And, wow, I still look like me, but a shinier, more elegant version of me. My eyebrows are clean and arched, my fingernails are gracefully painted, my skin glows even without a trace of makeup, my hair is gleaming and bouncy without a single speck of split ends. I look cultured, sophisticated, rich. Yep, that last one's the bullseye. This is why rich people always look put together, because they can afford to hire a team that specializes in putting them together. Just as I caress my cheek one last time, there's a knock at the door. I open it to find Fergus.
"The personal shopper is here, Miss Hammond,"
he kind of snarls, in a way that reminds me of Bosco.
"Shall I send her up?"
I automatically look around the room, checking for strewn clothes, out of habit. But the maids who flit by every hour or so would never let that happen. Sure, Fergus. Thank you. He dips his head and walks down the hall. A few minutes later, a tiny, chirping, beautiful French woman walks through my bedroom door. She looks young, maybe 20, and reminds me of Ellie, if my sister had brown hair and spoke French. Her name is Sabine, but in my head I call her French Ellie. Half a dozen male assistants carry in racks of clothes, dresses and pants and blouses and skirts. Then they go back downstairs and bring up bags of lacy undergarments, bras, panties, garters, and stockings. Finally, a tailor's platform is carried in, I assume for me to stand on. By the time the last assistant leaves, the white bedroom isn't so white anymore. It's covered in fabrics of every color. It's like the entire women's department at Barrister's exploded in here. Sabine holds up a piece of paper.
Bridget.
It's a list from Nicholas's secretary, Bridget. A list of events that I'll need clothes for. The party tonight, a polo match, another party, brunch, afternoon tea with the Queen. Oh, Jesus. Not for the first time, I wonder what the hell I was thinking. But then I stop. Because I'm here. And while I am, I'm going to be here. Be unafraid. Do everything. See everything. With Nicholas. Trying on clothes is exhausting. I never realized it until I'd done it for 2 hours straight. Just as I'm ready to ask for a break, the bedroom door opens without a knock, and Prince Henry glides in, carrying long-stemmed glasses and two bottles of Dom Perignon. He's wearing a black cashmere sweater with a white collared shirt underneath and tan slacks. It's a neat, preppy look that stands in contrast to his wild, wavy blonde hair and the tattoo on his forearm peeking out beneath his rolled-up sleeve. Henry Pembroke is a walking, living contradiction.
"Everyone's working," he says, holding up the bottles and glasses. "I'm bored. Let's get day drunk, Olive."
I look down at Sabine as she fixes the hem on a pair of trim black pants, smiling around the pins in her mouth. When in Rome, or Wesco. Okay. After the corks are sprung and the glasses full, Henry looks through the intimate apparel laid out on the bed.
"This would look fantastic on you, and that one there."
He plays with the pink ribbons that tie the front of a daring black lace bustier.
"Do these open?" "Oh, they do. Definitely this one. My brother will jizz in his pants when he sees you in it."
He snatches a peach silk baby doll nightie, shoving it in his pocket.
"The color's all wrong for you."
"I don't think it's your size, Henry," I tease. "Have you always liked women's clothes?" He smirks, reminding me of his brother.
"I like women. I know women. I know one woman who would like this bit very much. And I would enjoy seeing her wearing it."
Then he moves to the rack of cocktail dresses, going through them one by one.
"Crap, crap, crap."
Sabine is offended. "This is a Louis Lacher original."
"Oh."
Henry wiggles his eyebrows at me.
"Expensive crap."
Then he stops at a sexy black satin number with lace trim.
"This one, definitely."
He holds it up in front of me. In silver. It was made for you. Are you staying until the end of the summer?
That's the plan.
He glances to Sabine.
She'll need a ball gown, too. Preferably something in pale blue.
Then he explains.
For the summer jubilee, it's a party held every year here at the palace. A true ball. Old top hats and tails and heaving bosoms. Everyone attends.
Then I guess I'll need a ball gown.
Henry approaches Sabine slowly, speaking in a string of rapid French. I have no idea what he's saying, but I understand the blush that comes to her cheeks and the enamored glaze in her pretty eyes when she smiles and says,
"Oui, Henri."
While Sabine sorts the keepers from the rejects and sets up another round in the dressing area, Henry and I sit on the snow-white couch in the sitting room.
"So it's just that easy for you, huh?"
I ask him, referring to whatever proposition Sabine just agreed to with the naughty prince.
"Yes, just that easy."
Then he downs his champagne like a shot and immediately refills his glass. In the sunlight, the planes of his cheeks cast shadows, and his eyes, for a moment, take on a distant sheen. What were the words Nicholas used? Haunted, hunted. And the big sister in me opens her mouth.
"Are you okay, Henry? I know we just met, but your brother, he's worried about you."
He forces a laugh.
"Of course I'm okay. That's my job, my one job, to be okay all the time."
My hand finds his shoulder. "But it's all right not to be. I mean, everyone loses it once in a while. No one's okay all the time." I sip my champagne and add, "Except probably serial killers, and nobody wants to be around them." Henry laughs easier this time, and his soft green eyes drift over my face.
"I like you, Olivia. Truly. You're sweet and naturally honest. That's rare around here."
He guzzles half his glass, then takes a big breath and says,
"So, because I like you, I'm going to give you some advice, all right?"
"Okay."
"Don't get attached to my brother."
Everything inside me goes cold, as though my bones turn to hollow icicles, but my palms are sweating.
"He doesn't belong to you. He doesn't even belong to himself."
I swallow. "I understand that."
"See," he wags his finger. "You say that, but it doesn't seem like you understand it, not when you're looking at him."
When I don't reply, Henry goes on.
"I took a theology course in university, a discussion of the concept of heaven and hell. One theory is that heaven is being in the presence of God, having the light of his face shine down upon you, and hell is when he turns away and leaves you, and you know you'll never feel the perfection of that warmth and love again."
His voice lowers.
"That is what Nicholas is like. When he shines on you, the whole world is shining. But when he's disappointed, and because his standards are higher than God's, he will always eventually be disappointed. That is a fresh, cold hell."
It's hard to swallow. Nerves, I guess. Fear of the unknown. So I cling to my truth.
"That's not the Nicholas I know."
"Yes, he is different with you. Happier. More free."
Henry rests his hand on my knee.
"But you must remember, whether you know it or not, that's the man he is."
After dinner, another stylist shows up to get me ready for the party. She blows my hair out into long, silky tresses and coils the ends into big, bouncy curls. But I do my makeup myself. I don't like feeling too gooped up.
Nicholas doesn't seem excited about going.
"Required to make an appearance," he says. But he's very excited about my dress, a shimmery gray slip dress that swoops in front, offering a peak of cleavage. Around 9, we pull up to a mansion on a hill. No, not a mansion, an estate, with a historic-looking house about half the size of the palace, but still enormous. Security swarms, Secret Service-type men in tuxedos wearing little wire earpieces, but Nicholas still brings his own men, with James now leading the pack.
Nicholas holds my hand. I'm not sure if that qualifies as PDA, but he doesn't seem concerned. He leads me through a cavernous foyer, down a hall, through the open doors of a ballroom, and into a casino. A fully stocked, even better than Vegas, wood gaming tables, giant betting wheel casino. The room is crowded, with groups of elegantly dressed people, everyone young and beautiful, shouting and laughing and drinking. I'm surprised I'm able to spot him so easily, but I see Henry by the bar, looking not quite as dashing as his brother, but handsome in a black tuxedo, surrounded by a group of men and women hanging on his every word.
"So, what do you think?"
Nicholas whispers against my ear, giving me goosebumps. "I think... I know how Alice felt when she fell into Wonderland." He winks.
"We're all mad here."
A swirl of red silk flashes in front of my eyes, engulfing Nicholas in a cackling hug. She has thick, honey-colored hair and is as tall as Nicholas, like an Amazon woman, and every bit as stunning. It's the girl from the Marriage Watch piece on television and the People magazine pictures. The old friend Nicholas mentioned.
"There you are, you bloody sod! I blink and you disappear to the States for 2 months. How are you, love?"
Nicholas smiles.
"Hello, Ezzy. I'm very well."
Brandy eyes, as sparkly as the dangling rubies in her earrings, fall to me.
"I see that. Aren't you a pretty little thing?"
Nicholas introduces us.
"Lady Esmeralda, this is Olivia Hammond. Olivia, meet Ezzy."
"Hi, Ezzy." She shakes my hand in a friendly grip. "Lovely to meet you, sweets. Tell me, are you a virgin?" Nicholas groans.
"Ezzy."
"What? I'm just making conversation."
She elbows him.
"If you want a shot at this sorry sack, the V-card has to be in pristine condition. Is it, Olivia?"
I stand up tall.
"Does anal count? If it does, I qualify."
Esmeralda's red lips open wide in a contagious laugh.
"I like this one, Nicky."
Nicholas laughs too, and something like pride glows in his green eyes.
"So do I."
He grabs 2 glasses of wine off a waiter's tray and hands me one. But then another woman approaches us, another blonde in a royal blue gown with soft, pretty features and ice-blue eyes. A sedate, uncomfortable silence falls over Nicholas and Ezzy.
"Hello, Nicholas."
Her voice is delicate, like a wind chime. Nicholas nods.
"Lucy."
Her eyes fix on me.
"Aren't you going to introduce me to your new toy?"
His jaw tightens.
"No, I'm not."
She gives a tiny shrug.
"No matter."
She holds out her hand.
"I am Lady Derringer, and you are?"
"Olivia Hammond."
"I heard about you. The coffee waitress."
Her mouth purses and her gaze flicks to Nicholas.
"You always did enjoy slumming it, didn't you, darling?"
It's the darling that gets to me, that pokes at the flesh of my heart like a thorn.
"That's enough, Lucy,"
Nicholas says sternly, in that deep authoritarian voice. It has no effect on her at all.
"No, I don't think it is enough," she hisses like a cornered cat. "Not even close."
Her eyes slide back to me, and she leans in.
"He'll crush you, you know. It's what he does. Breaks you, then crushes you into dust with the heel of his shiny shoe."
It's the way she says it that's most disturbing. Gently, and smiling.
"Oh, for fuck's sake, Lucille, get over it," Ezzy barks, waving her hand. "Be gone before somebody drops a house on you."
She raises her glass to me.
"Remember that I told you so."
And then she drifts away, like smoke after a blaze. I take a big gulp of wine and decide not to get into whatever that was with Nicholas. At least not now.
"So, ex-girlfriend?" I ask, clearly unable to resist.
"More like ex-psycho-stalker,"
Esmeralda answers for him. Then she takes my hand. "Forget about her. Let's go lose some of Daddy's money." Nicholas takes a breath, nods, and we head off to the tables. But I don't lose anyone's money. An hour later, I'm up 8 black chips at the blackjack table. I think, I hope, they're worth 1,000 each. If it's any more than that, I'll be too freaked out to touch them. My dad taught me to play the game when I was 12. On his good days, we still play a few hands. Nicholas's big, warm hands squeeze my shoulders, and he speaks close to my ear. I have to head to the little lad's room. I look at him over my shoulder. Okay. Our eyes meet, and I know him well enough to recognize the look burning in his. He wants to kiss me, badly. He stares at my mouth like a starving man. But then he pulls back, looks around the room, remembers where we are. Izzy, mind Olivia for me a bit.
Yeah, sure.
She nods, and Nicholas walks away. But 15 minutes later, he still hasn't come back, and Esmeralda spots a group of friends she hasn't spoken to in ages. With a pat to my arm, she says she'll be back in a jiffy, and she heads off to them. Leaving me alone in the center of the room, feeling like an alien surrounded by Martians who sweat money and shit gold. I watch a white-gloved waiter slip through a swinging door, probably to the kitchen, and my feet itch to follow him. Because my home planet is behind that door, my people. Dozens of curious, unkind eyes appraise me as they float past, in groups of chatting, laughing twos and threes. So I lift the hem of my shimmery dress and walk closer to the wall to be less conspicuous. I slip my phone out of my purse and text Ellie, asking what she's up to. I talked to her and Marty last night, just after they'd finished closing the coffee shop. They sounded good. I sent them pics of my room and the palace grounds. Marty replied with so many emojis he probably broke the button. He's expressive like that. When she doesn't respond a few minutes later, I put my phone away, and I don't want to smother Nicholas, but at the same time, where the fuck is he? 5 more minutes pass, and my stomach turns twisty and sour. He knows I don't know anyone here. Why would he leave me alone? Screw it. I put my champagne glass on the tray of a passing waiter and set out to find him. Every room I wander through looks like the inside of a crystal chandelier, sparkling and glittery. And they're noisy, with pinging slot machines and cheering crowds. Royals like winning money, too, even when they already have it. Go figure. One room is dark, black, except for colored strobe lights, a glowing dance floor, and the pounding club music coming from the DJ's speakers. I spot Henry's unmistakable blonde head in the middle of the floor, surrounded by gyrating women, and I almost head over to him to ask if he's seen his brother. But then, I can't explain why, a door on the far side catches my attention. It leads outside, onto a balustraded balcony. By the time I reach it, my palms are sweating and clammy. My heels click on the tiled stone outside. I only go a few steps, and that's when I see them. At the far corner of the balcony, in the soft halo of a teardrop-shaped lamp. Nicholas and Lucy. I taste bile in the back of my throat. Her back is to me, her blonde hair cascading, her head tipped up to him and her forearms resting on those broad shoulders I love to touch. I can't tell if he's pushing her away or pulling her closer, and the sour sensation in my stomach seeps into my bones. Anger mixes with embarrassment, and flight kicks fight's ass. When I pull the door back open, I think I hear my name, but the sound is drowned out by the pumping bass that rattles the walls. I walk quickly, through the dance room, back into the main gambling room. I make it through the doorway, and then my arm is grabbed, encircled by an iron grip like a shackle. "Just where do you think you're going?" she asks, with a light Wesconian accent. I look up at her, and the breath literally whooshes out of me. Because she's the most breathtakingly beautiful woman I've ever seen, half a foot taller than me, with shiny dark brown hair, onyx eyes, perfect doll-like features, and pale, pristine skin.
Huh?
Nice recovery, Liv.
Let me guess.
You walked outside and saw Lucille and Nicholas, not quite kissing, but not kissing either.
How do you know that?
She snorts and manages to make it sound adorable.
Because Lucy is the most unoriginal bitch I've ever known.
She taps my nose. But you aren't going to run off. Absolutely not. You can't give her the satisfaction.
She plucks two fresh glasses of champagne off a passing tray, hands one to me, and clinks our glasses together.
Drink up and smile. You're being watched.
I peek around the room. Watched by who?
Everyone, of course. You're new and shiny and poor, and you have your hands on what every woman here, except me and Esmeralda, wants. The royal family jewels.
Her head tilts.
Are you really a waitress?
Why does everyone keep asking me that? I drink my champagne. Really, I chug the whole freaking glass. I deserve it.
Ah, yes. That idiot. I can't believe he brought you here.
She shakes her head, pitying.
The world is full of cunts, dearie. Some are just smellier than others. Remember that? And they'll never be able to hurt you.
I stare at her for a beat. Who are you? Her smile makes her even prettier.
I'm Lady Frances Eloise Alcott Barrister, but you can call me Franny.
Franny.
Franny! Simon's Franny! Bubble bath girl!
Franny pouts.
Did he put the call on speaker in front of a full house? I'm going to have a strongly worded chat with that husband of mine.
Strongly worded chat about what, Dove?
Simon asks, coming up beside her, his hand sliding affectionately around her waist. Franny grins at him.
Say the devil's name and he doth appear.
Simon makes devil horns on his red head with his fingers. Then he smiles at me, blue eyes dancing.
Olivia, it's a pleasure to see you again.
There's a warmth about him, a genuine sweetness that makes me feel comforted, without him even trying. Simon Barrister is the kind of guy that would stop to help someone with a flat tire even in a downpour, or help an old lady carry her groceries, or make silly faces at a kid having a meltdown.
Hello, Simon. It's good to see you, too.
How are you, my dear?
What a question to ask, Simon,
Franny swats him.
Look at the poor girl. She's overwrought. Lucille has been playing her nasty head games again.
Simon scrunches his nose.
You should ignore Lucy, Olivia. She's a bit of a vile bitch.
She's a cunt, Franny reiterates. My love is just too kind to say so.
She pats my arm.
But I'm not.
The jittery, sick feeling starts to creep up on me again. I think I just need some air.
Brilliant,
Franny says, taking my arm and guiding me toward the large French doors. Let's go out on the veranda for a smoke.
I just recently started the habit, trying to work off the pounds I gained from the honeymoon.
I suspect Franny might be a little crazy. The fun kind, not the scary kind. Outside, she smokes her cigarette while Simon talks business with a man beside him. Then she quickly stubs out her bud on the iron railing, her eyes trained on the open doors that lead into the ballroom.
He's found you.
I turn to look.
Nicholas?
She doesn't let me look.
Yes, he's coming this way.
She claps her hands together.
Now, when he arrives, you should smile gracefully and pretend like nothing in the world is wrong.
Why would I do that? I ask.
He won't know what to make of it. It'll drive him insane. A woman's weapons of mass destruction are indifference and confusion.
I feel like I should be writing this down.
He's coming. Get ready.
She smacks my lower back.
Chin up, tits out.
With a mind of their own, my chin lifts and my shoulders pull back, pushing my chest forward. And believe it or not, it actually makes me feel stronger, more capable.
Olivia.
Right up until he says my name. I close my eyes against the sound. The way he says it, there will never be a day that I don't love the sound of my name on his lips. Bracing myself, I turn Nicholas's way, but I don't actually look at his face. Instead,
I looked just over his right shoulder into the bright, glistening lights of a golden chandelier. I feel his gaze on my face, watching me, reading me. I don't have the chance to pretend that everything is fine, because without another word, Nicholas grabs my hand and pulls me toward the steps that lead off the veranda to the gardens. Come on. He guides me down a winding, dim path to a white trestle gazebo. Garden lights ring the outside, casting a soft glow, but under the roof it's dark and feels private. I hold my dress as I climb the steps. Why don't you like Franny? He told me in New York that they didn't get along, that he couldn't stand her, but he's surprised by my question.
Ah, from the moment Simon met her, he was enamored, but she gave him the brush off over and over again. The night he told her he was in love with her, she said she could never be with him. And when I came home, I found her in my bed, naked.
Jealousy, hot and biting, bites at me, and shock.
Did you sleep with her?
Of course not, he says, low and growly. I would never do that to Simon. I told him about it, but he didn't care. He said they were working through their issues. Shortly after, they were an item, and they got married a few months ago. I've given up trying to figure it out.
I sit down on the bench. Jesus, she doesn't seem like someone who would do that. She was nice to me. Nicholas stands in front of me, his face partially hidden by the darkness.
I'm glad she was nice to you, but things here aren't always what they seem. I should have told you that before.
He pushes a hand through his hair.
I should have told you a lot of things, Olivia, but I'm not used to saying things out loud.
I don't understand what that means. He sits down beside me, his voice hushed.
I want to tell you about Lucy. I want to explain.
I want to be the bigger woman. The kind who says he doesn't owe me an explanation, we're just temporary. But my heart pounds loudly that he does. Why were you with her? Why did you leave me alone? Did you kiss her, Nicholas? It looked like you could have been kissing her. His hand splays across my jaw.
I'm sorry you were on your own. I didn't mean for that to happen. No, I wasn't kissing her. I swear to you, on my parents. Nothing like that happened.
Relief loosens the pincers on my heart, because I know he would never mention his parents, not unless it was true. Then what did happen? He leans forward, resting his elbows on his knees, looking at the ground.
I met Lucy at school, Briar House, when we were both in year 10. She was the prettiest girl I'd ever seen. Fragile. In a way that made me want to keep her safe. We started dating. The media went into a frenzy, and I was worried it would scare her away. But it didn't bother her, and I remember thinking she was stronger than I thought.
He takes a breath, rubbing the back of his neck.
She became pregnant when we were 17. I was stupid, careless.
Oh my God! He nods, looking at me.
Pregnancy at that age is difficult for anyone, but add in...
The whole future leader of a country thing, I finish for him.
And it was a horror show. Her family wanted to start planning the wedding immediately, wanted the palace to announce our engagement. My grandmother demanded tests and retests to confirm that she was really pregnant and that it was really mine.
And again, I'm struck by the strangeness of Nicholas's life. The archaic rules that box him in. What did you want? I ask, because I have a strong feeling no one else did.
I wanted to do the right thing. I loved her.
He rubs his face.
In the end, it didn't matter. Just a few weeks after she found out, she lost the baby. A miscarriage. She was heartbroken.
And you? He doesn't answer right away. Then, softly, he says,
I was relieved. I didn't want that responsibility. Not yet.
I rub his shoulder. That's understandable. He swallows and nods.
When the year ended, my grandmother sent me to Japan for the summer, a humanitarian mission. Lucy and I talked at first, texted, but I was so busy. When I came back to school in the fall, things were different. I was different. I cared for her, but my feelings had changed. I broke it off, as gently as I could, but she still took it badly.
Sadness washes through me like a wave.
How badly? She tried to kill herself a week later. Her family sent her away to a hospital. A good place, but she never came back to school. And I've always felt guilty about it all. Responsible. It stayed out of the papers. I don't know who the palace had to pay off or kill to keep it that way, but there wasn't a single line written about it.
Is that why you're so careful? About the condoms?
Yes.
With a tug, he gathers me in his lap, hugging me close, and I know this wasn't easy for him. Thank you for telling me, for explaining. We stay just like that, shrouded in shadows and earthy-scented air. Then I ask, should we go back to the party? He thinks about it, and gives me a little squeeze.
I have a better idea.
The Horny Goat. It reminds me of a pub in New York, comfortable, familiar, and a little sticky. After Nicholas gathered Simon and Franny, Henry and a cute redhead that was clinging to his arm, the six of us ditched the casino house party and ended up at the Horny Goat for the rest of the night. I did tequila shots with Franny, Henry sang karaoke, Simon and Nicholas insulted one another about their dart-throwing skills. By the end of the night, in the early morning hours, Nicholas and I stumbled into his room, fell onto his bed, and fell asleep, fully clothed, wrapped around each other, and happy.
Chapter 18. Nicholas. The following week is blissfully uneventful. I address palace business during the day and share my nights with Olivia, which are so much more than blissful. During the day, she relaxes like I want her to. She walks the grounds and has found a friend in Franny. They've had lunch together several times, which doesn't exactly thrill me, but at the very least, I know she's safe with Simon's wife. Franny and her forked tongue will protect Olivia from the Lucy types looking to wound her with their half-truths. On the rare occasions my brother is sober, he becomes increasingly agitated, like he's unable to sit still, to stand his own company, or any sound that resembles silence. Finally, he decides to throw a welcome home party for himself. I'm in my bathroom preparing for his royal yacht party, just showered with a towel around my hips, scraping the last of the shaving cream off my jaw, when Olivia appears in the doorway. I thought she was lovely from the first moment I saw her, but here, now, her bare, soft skin wrapped in a pink silk robe, her face glowing with well-rested happiness, she's magnificent.
So, do you guys have like a gift shop or a convenience store around here?
I laugh. A gift shop? She holds up a light blue disposable razor.
I'm out of razors. This one's so dull I could run it over my tongue without drawing blood.
Let's not test that theory. I like your tongue too much. I wipe my chin with a towel. I can have the staff bring one to your room. The devil on my shoulder, and the angel, too, smack me upside the head, and they whisper a much better idea. Or I could help you out. Her brows draw together.
Help me out. I can't use your razor.
No, definitely not. You'd cut yourself to ribbons. I finger the sharp, heavy, straight blade. What I mean is, I could shave for you. Her eyes darken, the way they do when she's right on the edge, right before she comes, and she moves closer to me.
Do you want to do that?
My gaze drags down, down, over every sumptuous inch of her body.
Oh, yes. All right, she agrees, intense and breathless. The corner of my mouth drags up as I gently skim the robe back over her shoulders and slide it down, revealing pale, full curves and soft, mouth-watering swells. I scoop Olivia up under her legs and perch her on the vanity, her legs dangling off. The cold marble makes her squeak, and we both chuckle. Then she reaches up for a kiss, but I drag myself back. Uh-uh, none of that now. I need to focus all of my attention. I slip my hand across her thigh, cupping between her legs. Here. Olivia's eyes roll closed at the contact, and her hips lift up against my palm just a bit. All I want to do is slip my finger into her wet, tight heat, to get her all needy and clenching for my cock. I blow out a breath. This is going to be more fucking difficult than I thought. I lick my lips as I mix the shaving cream into a warm, thick lather, feeling her eyes follow my every move. I run a hand towel under the warm water, wring it out, and wrap it around her calf to heat and soften the skin. And then I paint her with the cashmere brush, dragging the bristles up her leg over the grooves of her sculpted calf, leaving a trail of white cream behind. I breathe evenly, steadying myself when I reach for the razor, scraping it gently over her skin. I rinse the blade, then go back for more, repeating the slow movements again and again. After both calves and her knees are done, I get to work on each thigh. Olivia pants and then gasps when the bristles tickle the delicate skin at the apex between her legs. When the razor traces the same path, reaches that juncture, she moans, and all I want to do is rip the towel off my hips and fuck her endlessly on the bathroom counter. My cock is aching, weepy, and every muscle in my body is strung so tight it borders on pain. I save the best for last. A sweet, beautiful pussy. I repeat the process. Warm towel first. Resting it over her and rubbing her clit beneath it. Because how can I not? She starts to shift, writhe, and I have to admonish her. Stay still. I have to stop if you don't sit still. Yes, I'm teasing her, taunting, because there's no bloody way in hell I could stop now. Olivia grips the edge of the counter until her knuckles are white, and she stares at me with shiny eyes glazed over with mindless lust. Once she's covered in cream, I toss the brush into the sink. I press the razor against her flesh, at the bottom, those plump, perfect lips, and I pause, looking into her eyes. You trust me? She nods, almost frantically, and I slide the razor up, removing barely visible tiny sprouts of hair. I move to her vulva, sweeping downward in short, careful strokes, being sure to leave her pretty, soft bush that I enjoy so much. When I'm done, I set the razor aside and pick up the still warm towel. Then I kneel down in front of her. I clean any last remnant of shaving cream from her skin, and then I look up into her eyes. And I watch her watch me, as I lean forward and cover her pussy with my mouth. Yes, yes, she hisses. I suck and lick and devour her like a man gone mad, and maybe I have. She's so slick and smooth and hot on my lips, against my tongue. I could stay here, do this to her, forever. But forever is much too long for my suffering cock. Breathing hard, heart pounding out of my chest, I stand up and tear at the towel around me. I push Olivia's knees up, bracing her feet on the edge of the counter near her hands, opening her up to me. So fucking pretty. I take my long, hot erection in hand and run the head through her wetness, teasing her clit with the tip, rubbing it over the pink bud. And there's no worry. not a single thought of consequence or responsibility. Because this is Olivia, and that makes all the difference.
Are you sure?
She asks. I drag my cock down to her tight opening, gliding it around, feeling the call to thrust hard and deep.
Yes, yes, I'm sure.
Olivia nods and I dip inside her. She closes tight around me, gripping and snug, making me moan loudly.
Oh, Christ!
The bareness, flesh to flesh, is amazing. More. The slick slide of tight heat that brings so much pleasure with it. I watch as I push all the way into her, feeling every gorgeous inch. It's the most erotic sight I've ever seen. Olivia moans. We both do. And I know without a shred of doubt that we are going to be very, very late for Henry's party.
Olivia. By the time we actually leave the palace, it's so late that Nicholas has Bridget call ahead to tell them to hold the gangplank for us. He says we'll just be cruising around the bay, but I hope Henry isn't pissed at us for delaying his party. I shouldn't have worried. After we board, it's immediately apparent Henry is too drunk to notice or care. He hugs us both sloppily, like he hasn't seen us in weeks.
"So damn happy you made it," he howls,
throwing his arms out wide.
"I love this fucking boat."
Nicholas's eyes crinkle with concern.
"It's actually a ship, little brother."
Henry rolls his eyes and almost falls over.
"Don't you ever get tired of correcting people. Have a fucking drink."
We do just that. I tried to imagine what a royal yacht would look like, but just like practically every other experience on this wild trip, my imagination falls sadly short. The ship has every luxury imaginable. It's a floating palace, and almost as large. Strings of lights dot the sky above the deck, and some of the guests, also drunk but not quite as bad as Henry, turn it into a makeshift dance floor. They grind and twist to the beat of the music coming from the DJ's speakers at the helm. Kanye West is playing, and I laugh to myself, remembering my and Nicholas's first date. It seems so long ago. So much has happened. So much has changed. With our drinks in hand, Nicholas and I mingle. He introduces me to aristocrat after aristocrat. Dukes and barons and ladies and one marchioness, whatever the hell that is. We find Franny and Simon and stick pretty close to them. About an hour later, we stand against the railing, a slight breeze blowing my hair, but not enough to do any damage, while Simon starts to talk about his plans for expanding barristers, how he wants to branch out into other products. I look over at Nicholas and my heart skips, because he isn't listening to Simon. His focus is across the deck at the opposite railing. I've never seen Nicholas look terrified before. But that's exactly the emotion that's frozen on his face.
"Henry,"
he whispers, but only to himself. And then he shouts it.
"Henry!"
He rushes forward, running across the deck, and I turn just in time to see what scared him to death. Henry's laughing, leaning too much on the railing at his side. And then, silently, he goes over it. Someone screams. Nicholas yells his brother's name again. A guard makes the mistake of trying to stop him, and he gets an elbow to the nose for his trouble. When Nicholas reaches the spot where his brother just stood, he doesn't pause for a second, but grabs the railing of the ship and hops over, feet first. And both of Wesco's princes have gone overboard. Security men in black suits wait outside the door of the private hospital room. Someone brought Nicholas a dry change of clothes, jeans and a simple black T-shirt. He changed after the head doctors gave him and the Queen's advisor an update on Henry. They believe he hit his head on the way down. A mild concussion, with all signs pointing toward no lasting damage. But that doesn't make Nicholas feel any better. He sits in the chair at the foot of the bed, leaning forward with his elbows on his knees, strung tight and tense, jaw clenched, his eyes never leaving his unconscious brother.
as if he can wake him up with the intensity of his stare. The room is deathly quiet, except for the sound of Henry's deep, even breaths and the blip of the heart monitor. It's just the two of us, but I don't feel awkward or out of place. There's no desire to offer to get him something to eat or a cup of coffee. Because I know Nicholas only wants me, needs me, right here. So there's no place on earth I'd rather be. I put my hand on his shoulder, kneading the rock-hard tendon. He turns his head, and his eyes meet mine. And God, they're simmering. Awash with sadness and guilt and anger. Like he can't decide if he wants to cry or beat the crap out of his brother. I'd feel the same way if it were Ellie. I'd want to shake her and hug her and strangle her all at the same time. So I give him a small smile and a nod. And as if he can sense Nicholas's attention isn't solely on him, Henry stirs. His thick blonde brows draw together and he moans. Then slowly his eyes, so similar to the beautiful gray-green of his brother's, creak open. They're unfocused, slowly scanning the room before coming to rest on Nicholas, growing more alert with every second. In a dry, cracked voice, he mutters, "Stupid fucking boat." After a moment, Nicholas shakes his head, pinning his brother to the bed with his gaze, his words quiet and ragged. "No more, Henry. We're all that's left of them, you and I. And you can't. No more." Pain creases Henry's face, chasing away the cheery mask he always has glued there. "What happened?" Nicholas asks. "I know something happened. It's eating away at you, bit by bit, and you're going to tell me what it is. Now." Henry nods, licks his lips, and asks for a glass of water. I pour him a cup from the plastic pitcher on the side table. After a few long drags on the straw, he sets it aside and rubs his eyes. When he speaks, he looks away from his brother, down toward the far corner of the room, almost as if he's seeing the words play out in front of him. "It was about 2 months before my service was up. They'd kept me far from anything that resembled action. It was like a garden party. You know how it is." Nicholas explained this to me. High-profile target. That's what he and his brother were. Although their training was the same as the other soldiers, when they deployed, they received special assignments, because they were under a special threat, because the princes would make a very shiny trophy. And then, one day, the dark suits said they had a morale mission, a publicity opportunity. They wanted me to visit an outpost, still in the safe zone, but outside the main installation. There was a group of men who'd been there for a while, and they needed a boost, a visit from their prince, a reward for service well done. Henry scrapes his teeth across his lip, almost biting. We drove out, and I met them, about 15 in all. They were good blokes. One was like a crusty old bulldog. He wanted to set me up with his granddaughter. Another, he was only 18. Tears swell in Henry's eyes, and his voice bends, then breaks. He'd never kissed a girl, and he was looking forward to getting back home, to change that. He scrubs at his face, rubbing the tears into his skin. So I told some jokes, made them laugh. We took a bunch of photographs, and then we headed back out. We were on the road maybe 7 minutes, when the first rockets came in. I told the driver to turn round, to go back, but he wouldn't listen to me. "What's the point of all this if they don't listen?" he asks in a tortured voice. I punched the lad next to me, crawled over his lap and rolled out of the Humvee, and I ran. Henry chokes on a sob. I swear, Nicholas, I ran as hard as I could, but when I got there was nothing left. It was just pieces. I cover my mouth with my hand, and I'm crying with him. Henry gives a long, sniffling inhale, wiping at his face again. And I can't get past it. Maybe I'm not supposed to. Maybe it should eat at me bit by bit. He looks at Nicholas, and his voice turns bitter. Those men died
because of me. They died for a photo op.
At first, Nicholas doesn't say anything. He gazes at